man. Hell gapes, Erebus now lies open. The mouths of death wait on thy end.
Hear now the words. Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This is episode 87, presenting chapters 11 through 15 of By Air Express to Venus, or Captives of a Strange People, by Roy Rockwood. This is the first time I've done a show with all Air Express to Venus chapters. I had a request from a listener not to mix different books in the course of a single show, and so I'm going to try that out. Although some of the books I have read have very long chapters, and when a chapter is, let's say, 30 or 40 minutes long, I have the choice of cutting the show short or putting something else in as well. But I suppose we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Quite a few incidents in the course of these five chapters, some of them absolutely absurd. I'm sorry, but orbital mechanics just does not work like that. We're treated to what reminds me of the Venusian Aikido from Doctor Who, and reminded not to take our masks off before it's completely safe. We get a glimpse of deflector beams, and it is revealed that the Venusians do indeed use telephones, so why Gozona was so perplexed by one at the beginning of the book becomes a complete mystery. For longtime listeners, a bigger mystery may be, what have I been doing since show number 86? And this is a question that I am sadly not well able to answer. While I cannot promise two new shows a week, I certainly do not intend to take another such hiatus in the future. One thing is for certain, I have quite a lot of material recorded and ready to be edited to make up new shows. The big news is undoubtedly that I am leaving Twitch as a streaming platform. The SDF video platform, TubeNix, which is an instance of PeerTube, is now supporting live streaming, and that's where I am going to be streaming from now on. I plan to do one final Twitch stream to let everybody know of my intention of moving, and then it will be on live.tubenix.org. From then on. And you can find the link to my Hear Now the Word channel either under the DJs tab at the Anon Radio website, under Publius, and you have to find the Hear Now the Word master post, or you can go to my SDF-hosted website homepage, publius.ntfn.org. That's Papa Uniform Bravo Lima India Uniform Sierra dot November Tango Foxtrot November dot Oscar Romeo Golf, and scroll down to Live Action Audiobooks to find the link. Chapter 11, Blasts of Ether. For several tense moments, a space of time that seemed longer than it really was, Mark Sampson, Jack Darrow, and Professor Gustavus Hertz stood at their posts, their masks covering their faces, intently watching Protexa and Soli, who were close to the engine of gold. Its deadly drawing power had been neutralized now that it was functioning to help send the blue streak through space. Suddenly, the Venusian engineer, who had been closely observing a clock gauge, pushed forward a lever. There was a further vibration of the Air Express, and Mark and Jack wondered what was going to happen. But all that occurred was that Protexa removed his mask and motioned to the others to do the same. Since their entire heads were covered, they could not hear his voice. "Well, that's a relief," exclaimed Jack, as he laid aside the grotesque protector. "I should say so," agreed his chum. "It was not exactly pleasant," admitted Professor Hertz, as he laid aside his head covering. "But I suppose it was necessary."
very necessary, stated Protexa. Without them, as we pass through the atmosphere of your Earth, we should all have been killed, but there is no more danger.
How about it when we strike the atmosphere of Venus? Asked Jack. Shall we have to put on the masks again?
The chief engineer shook his head in negation.
Our atmosphere is not like yours, he said. However, have no fears, he added quickly, as he saw what was engendered in the minds of the others. You will be able to breathe it even as we breathed yours. The atmosphere of Venus lacks certain elements which the Earth air has, and which, in conjunction with the emanations from our propelling gas, mean danger on your planet.
Then I am right in assuming that this blue streak is propelled by the issuance of exploding gas, just as is a rocket, asked the German scientist eagerly. For, up to now, the exact method of sending the Air Express through space had been a jealously guarded secret from the Earth dwellers, notwithstanding that they had worked on the machinery, including the engine of gold.
It operates on the rocket principle, admitted Protexa, but in a much more powerful fashion than any machine you have ever seen.
In one way, this trip was no novelty to the three Earth passengers, since they had several times sailed through immense spaces in a machine somewhat similar to the Blue Streak. But it was their hope and expectation that on Venus they would encounter beings new and strange to them, and that they would have some novel experiences. Professor Hertz hoped to be able to make some valuable scientific observations, and to settle long-disputed questions regarding the planet. Having set the machinery to produce the maximum speed of their air express, and also having adjusted the guiding compass so that it would keep the great projectile pointed for Venus, Protexa stated that no further attention need be paid to the apparatus unless something unforeseen should occur.
So you may wander about as you please, he told Professor Hertz and the two young students. Jantu you will, of course, not disturb, he added gravely.
There seemed to the young man to be something that Protexa was keeping back. However, what he said next occupied Jack and Mark to the exclusion of worrisome thoughts, at least for a time.
You Earth dwellers, went on the Venusian with a smile, will naturally want to eat the Earth food you have brought with you. You may make your own cooking and meal arrangements. As for my companions and me, we drink only Bitam, and for food smell Gasto. It saves much time, he suggested.
Indeed it does, agreed Professor Hertz. I have often felt how foolish it is to spend so many hours preparing food which is disposed of in so short a time at a table. Your way seems much better, my friend Protexa, though I cannot deny, he added with a smile, that I like my food.
Same here, echoed Jack.
Mark wondered if it did not take time to distill the gasto from flowers, though all he said aloud was, when we get to Venus we may do as the Venusians do.
I fear it will take more than a brief stay on our planet to enable you to live on Bitam and Gasto, said Gozona with a smile as she approached the group in the engine room. But I hope you will stay with us a long time, she added genially.
Is there any food there we can eat? Asked Jack, and the same thought was in Mark's mind as was in his, that he would not object to living on Venus the rest of his life if he could have the companionship of Gozona.
From what I have observed of you while we were on your Earth, said the girl in blue, I should say that you might be able to exist on Venus as you do on your own planet, but that remains to be seen. We are still a long way off.
But we're getting there, exclaimed Jack, looking at a speed gauge and observing that they were exceeding 345,000 miles per hour. But in the solid air express, breathing the same atmosphere as that of the Earth, the air being distilled from certain chemicals on board, they were hardly sensible of their motion, so smooth was it. The Blue Streak was not like an airship as ordinarily constructed. It was more like the machines in which Mark and Jack had visited the Moon and Mars, as well as the city beyond the clouds, and so straight and swift did it progress that it was like riding inside a bullet. There were no air pockets or bumps to shake up and disconcert the travelers.
We certainly got off to a blaze of fireworks, chuckled Jack, as they left the engine room for the more comfortable living room or main cabin. I wonder if we broke up any more radio sets.
Very likely we did, for which I am sorry, said Protexa, who had been told about the rather startling phenomena that had followed the first appearance of the blue fire above the Earth. It is one of the manifestations of our power that we have not yet been able to control, he added. We know about radio,
those we have on Venus are much nearer perfection than yours. Soli and Jantu tried to signal by means of the radio when they were moving to and fro, trying to find Gozona and me, he went on.
That must have been the queer language Professor Henderson heard before his radio blew up, observed Mark.
I also heard it, said Professor Hertz.
Is the radio on the blue streak working? Asked Mark eagerly.
Oh, yes, was the answer. You may tune in your Earth if you wish. Perhaps I had better get some station for you. Is there any particular one you would like to hear?
Get PXYD, suggested Jack. That's the biggest one near our home.
Maybe they'll be broadcasting something about the sensation we must have created when we left our planet.
When the loudspeaker at last picked up and greatly magnified the wireless signals from Earth, all on board listened to an excited broadcaster telling of a phenomenon that had just occurred. It was the launching of the Blue Streak, but of course the announcer did not know this.
There has occurred within the last hour, said the broadcaster in station PXYD, a most startling series of events. In the mountains north of here there was observed that same queer blue light in the sky which was first noted several weeks ago, and which was followed by the destruction of, or damage to, a large number of radio sets. For a time after that, as will be recalled, the blue light disappeared. Now it has been observed again, but the comet, meteor, or whatever it was that caused the manifestation appeared to be going away from the Earth instead of coming toward it.
He's right there, chuckled Jack.
Sure is, agreed Mark. Station PXYD is one of the few not damaged by this queer blue light, the announcer went on. In consequence, we are able to broadcast this news. We are constantly getting reports of stations all about us, as well as private sets, having been destroyed or greatly damaged by this queer blue fire. As soon as we get further information, announcements will be made. Meanwhile, we shall go on with our regular program. The Uberb Comedy 4 will now entertain you with music and songs.
Tune them out. They're terrible, exclaimed Mark.
Protexa shut off the radio and, turning to his guests, said with a smile,
You have heard how it was. Our departure from the Earth must have caused a sensation.
Yes, agreed Professor Hertz. Especially as few outside of our own working force had any inkling of what caused the phenomena they had witnessed. I should like to read the papers.
We shall not trouble them again, said Protexa with a smile, for I think we have had enough of the Earth, have we not? He asked his cousin with a smile.
Yes, she answered. I never want to go back there. I was much disappointed in that planet, but not wholly in the inhabitants of it, she added quickly, and with a warm smile toward Mark, Jack, and the older scientist. Without you, we should all have perished. But when Protexa and I first formed the design of going to your Earth, we hoped we might find blue water even better than our own, and flowers and herbs from which we might distill a perfume that would prolong life beyond the span we have on Venus, which is longer than yours, she said. But we were disappointed, and with that and the accident we suffered and our treatment by the gypsies, Earth is not a happy memory for us. Though we are very grateful to you, she said, bowing prettily.
We hope we shall like Venus more than you liked our Earth, Mark said. They were being propelled through a vast, dark space, but the Air Express was well lighted within by means of tubes of curious glowing gas which hung from the ceiling of the different compartments. Mark and Jack were getting something to eat from the food they had brought with them when suddenly a pale glow seemed to spread throughout the blue streak. For a moment they could not imagine what it was, but an instant later Professor Hertz exclaimed,
It is the sun! We have passed beyond the shadow of the Earth, and from now on shall be in perpetual sunshine.
Sure enough, agreed Jack.
That is, until we reach Venus, went on the scientist. Then, if that planet revolves, as does ours, we shall have night and day again.
Venus is much like your Earth in that respect, said Protexa, and for the first time the German-American realized that he and Professor Henderson might have settled some of the vexed questions by making inquiries of Protexa before the blue streak had left the Earth. But it was too late now to acquaint Professor Henderson with the truth.
I'll tell him when I get back, decided Gustavus Hertz to himself. That is, if I ever do get back.
The internal lights of the blue streak were now dimmed, except those in dark corners of the engine room, and the two young scientists and their German-American friend ate their first meal on board, a sort of early breakfast, while the Venusians partook of their blue water and smelled the volatile gasto. Suddenly, just as they finished their meal, Jack and his companions experienced a curious lurching of the Air Express. It seemed to swerve to one side.
"What's the matter?" asked Mark.
"Ether blasts," answered Protexa, hurrying toward the engine room.
"We are in the path of a terrible force. I was afraid of this,"
he went on, and then he talked excitedly to Soli, who hurried with him to the control room. Meanwhile, the blue streak was whirling about strangely. Chapter 12. A Strange Attack.
"Come, you must help us," said Protexa to the Earth Dwellers as he hurried from the main cabin. "We are in great danger."
"What is it?" asked Jack.
"Tell us what to do, and we'll help," added Mark.
He and Jack saw Gozona hastening toward the room in which they knew the injured Jantu was lying. They had not yet set eyes on him. Even when his door had been open, as they passed his cabin, they could not get a glimpse of him, for there was a screen in front of the door.
"It is a terrific wind that is blowing us off our course," explained Protexa as he rushed into the engine room. "If we are forced too far to one side, we shall never reach Venus."
"Where shall we get to?" asked Mark.
"Unless we can get out of the influence of this wind, we shall be whirled about in its stream forever," answered the Venusian.
"Whew!" whistled Jack. "A modern Flying Dutchman, one might say. This sounds bad."
"How can there be a wind when we are beyond the Earth's atmosphere? And as is well known, wind is nothing but air in motion," asked Professor Hertz.
"Wind, as you know it, is air in motion,"
agreed the captain of the Blue Streak as he rapidly turned wheels and dials in the engine room.
"But in the vastness of the space of the solar system, there are ether blasts, as we call them, which, while they are not winds as you know them, are yet fully as terrible and destructive. As nearly as our scientists can determine, it is a form of swiftly moving vacuum."
"That's as bad as a big wind," agreed Mark.
"But what can we do?" "We must increase our speed and get out of the path of the ether blast," was the answer. "Whether or not we can do that remains to be seen. The engine is running at almost full power now. If I force it too much, danger may result, but we must try."
He was changing several machines and pieces of mechanism, but as yet with no result. Soli was doing the same, but the Blue Streak was still in the grip of that terrible unseen power, coming whence no one knew, going whither no one could guess.
"I had better tell you more about our source of power," went on Protexa, beckoning Mark and the two other Earth inhabitants to come nearer to the engine of gold over which he was leaning. "The time may come when you will have to take charge."
"Why would that be?" asked Mark.
"Something may happen to Soli or me," was the reply. "Poor Jantu will not be able to help. You may have to depend on yourselves if I should be disabled, or if something should happen to Soli, so I will show you how to regulate your speed and how to start and stop the mechanism. You know enough about navigation, for you have been to Mars and to the Moon."
"Yes, I think we can navigate space all right," agreed Mark. "And it's about time we knew how to run the Blue Streak," added Jack, "for if you folks aren't coming back to Earth in her, we'll have to drive it ourselves."
"Oh, are you going to return to Earth in this?"
asked Protexa, and his voice and manner showed surprise as he looked at the three Earth dwellers curiously.
"Why, of course, we're coming back to Earth in this or some machine like it," answered Mark.
"Gozona promised us that," stated Professor Hertz.
"Oh, did she?" asked Protexa. "I didn't know. Well, doubtless she will keep her word," he went on as he turned aside.
This impressed the three travelers as being rather curious, and they had a moment or two of uneasiness. But the Blue Streak then began tumbling about in such a queer way, swaying, plunging, careening, and almost turning over at times, that they were in desperate straits.
"We've got to do something!" cried Jack.
"There is only one thing to do. Increase our speed," repeated Protexa. "It is done in this manner," he went on, "by increasing the quantity of this substance that is fed into the engine. That is the fuel," and he indicated a magazine of dark-colored powder on top of the engine of gold. "This gives more speed," he said, pointing to a lever, "and this less," and he showed the Earth travelers a second handle. "But beyond this point, it is dangerous to drive the engine."
He indicated a mark on the scaled segment of the speed lever.
"I am now going to use our utmost force," he added. "If it does not pull us out of the grip of the ether blast, we are doomed."
He opened the valve that allowed some of the brown powder to sift into a hopper. At the same time, he shoved the speed lever over to its limit. For a moment, it was a question as to which would win, the powerful blue streak or the ether blast. For a few seconds, the projectile-like airship swayed back and forth. Then it slowly tilted forward and resumed what might be called a horizontal position, though in space there is no horizon. But it was once more flying along on its long axis, as it was designed to do after leaving the Earth.
"We are saved," murmured Protexa. "The engine of gold has brought us free of the ether blast."
Soli and Protexa conversed for a moment in their own language, and then the captain of the Blue Streak, Protexa, reduced speed to save the engine from tearing itself apart.
"You may go back to the main cabin now,"
said Protexa, when he had signified that Jack and the others might leave the machines to which they had hurriedly been assigned when the emergency occurred.
"I think we shall be all right now, at least for a time."
Soli left the control room and went to another part of the ship.
"So, Gozona said you were to return to Earth in this craft, did she?"
asked Protexa, when he was left alone with the Earthborn.
"Yes, is there anything strange in that?" Jack inquired.
"We did not plan to remain forever on Phinos," said the professor.
"I did not know exactly what the plans were," murmured Protexa, and he seemed in a strange confusion. "But doubtless if Gozona said so, it will be done. She is your friend."
"Sure," murmured Mark. "We've got to get back to Earth. Maybe she will come back with us," he suggested.
"Never!" exclaimed Protexa, and he spoke with great force. "She must remain with us on Venus."
Jack and Mark looked at each other. This bore out their first impression that Protexa was in love with the beautiful maiden in blue. Well, he was not the only one. With the Blue Streak again on an even keel, if that term may be employed concerning such a strange craft, matters were now easier on board. The visitors were shown to their small but well-equipped staterooms, and, as they had been up all the night before, they decided to get some sleep.
"There will be no danger for at least another day," said Protexa. "Should emergency arise, however, I will summon you."
So, in spite of their strange surroundings and the novel trip they were making, Professor Hertz and the two young men composed themselves to sleep. Before retiring, Jack and Mark had drawn thick curtains over the glass of the ports in their little staterooms to shut out the glaring light. Now, as Jack awakened, he saw that this curtain had been pulled aside, though he did not remember doing it, and the light of the sun was streaming in on him as he lay in the berth. The light of the sun revealed something else. This was the figure of a big man coming into the room, a man around whose head was bound a cloth stained red. Jack knew at once who the intruder was, Jantu, the injured Venusian. "Hope you're feeling better," Jack said, thinking the man had gotten into his stateroom by mistake. "Glad to see you." With a snarl like that of a wild beast, the big man from Venus sprang toward Jack, his fingers working convulsively as though eager to be about the young man's throat. At the same time, Jantu cried out something in his own language, and then in English he muttered,
"You kill, will I. Not to Venus shall you go with Gozona. Never. You kill, will I."
Then he attacked Jack fiercely. Chapter 13. Yellow Snow. For a few seconds, Jack Darrow thought he was in the midst of a terrible and all too realistic dream. But though for an instant he thought it might be some strange dream or phantasmagoria of his brain caused by the excitement he had just experienced in leaving the Earth, Jack soon realized that it was a real man with whom he had to deal, and a madman at that. The light of madness blazed forth from the eyes of Jantu, if ever insanity was recognizable. Jack realized this as he rolled to one side, just in time to escape those clutching fingers which were ready to grasp his throat. "Get out of here! What's the matter with you?" yelled Jack, thinking, by a voice of authority, he might turn the fellow from his purpose. But Jantu was not that kind.
"You will I kill!"
he yelled in a strange voice, and though he used the English words as Gozona had first used hers in the excitement of appealing to Jack and Mark, it was evident that this member of the party from Venus was not as adept in the tongue of the Earth dwellers as were his companions. He sprang at Jack, and though the young man, by fairly rolling out of his berth, was able to escape the clutching hands for a moment, they closed on him a second later in the small room, and the two came to deadly grips.
If Jack Darrow had the notion that he could toss Jan to his side, escape from him, or perhaps bring the madman to his senses by a show of force, the young scientist soon discovered his error. It was evident that Jan Tu meant to put his dire threat into execution.
"He's getting the best of me," thought Jack, as he felt the fingers about his throat.
Once he tore them loose, but with desperate cunning the fellow fainted, causing Jack to lower his guard, and a moment later again had a deadly grip. By this time Jack realized that he could not fight this madman alone, so, in a hoarse voice, with what little breath he could force past his constricted throat, he gasped,
"Help! Help! Mark! Professor! He's killing me!"
Jack's voice alone, smothered as it was by the choking he was undergoing, might not have sufficed to bring help. But in his seeming triumph, Jan Tu himself let out a wild yell, and this carried to the farthest part of the blue streak. On hearing the yell, Protexa, followed by Mark and the professor, rushed to Jack's stateroom. In their excitement, they blocked the doorway so that no one could enter. However, they could see what was going on. They had a glimpse of the figure of Jan Tu, with his bloody bandage, bending over Jack, and glimpsed the latter's bulging eyes and scarlet face.
"Let me get at him! Call Soli!" cried Protexa to Mark and the professor.
Realizing that he could do more than they could, they swung aside. Protexa flung himself on Jantu's back and fairly pulled him off Jack. But, with a wild snarl of rage, Jantu pulled himself loose and again reached for the youth, now prostrate on his berth, quite exhausted. Then Protexa gave a remarkable exhibition of power. He swung Jantu about with one motion of his arm and then, extending the fingers of his two hands out like so many thorns, held them in front of the madman's face. Mark and the professor were conscious of some weird flow of power from Protexa's fingers into the body of the enraged man. They could see nothing, any more than one could observe the flow of hypnotic power, but it seemed to be something of that nature, for in a few seconds the madman's clenched hands fell limply to his sides, his eyes lost their wild glare, and he whimpered like a naughty child. Then Protexa spoke to him in that strange language of Venus. Soli, summoned by Mark, came hastily up the corridor, and behind him was Gozona, much agitated.
"Did he harm anyone?" she asked quickly. "Oh, poor Jack!"
And she glided into the stateroom and placed one of her beautiful hands on the forehead of the limp youth. As she did so, it seemed as though a spasm of rage thrilled Jan Tu. But Protexa murmured a few words, stabbed his extended fingers at him, and the fellow limply subsided. At the same time, Soli led him out into the corridor, and Mark and the professor had a glimpse of Soli now making mesmeric passes over the head of the injured man. His two companions had subdued Jan Tu by a strange exhibition of secret and unseen power. It was remarkable.
"Poor boy,"
murmured Gozona, and Mark wished the thing had happened to him as he saw her solicitude. But Jack opened his eyes and murmured,
"I'm all right now. He choked me a little, but there's no harm done. I'm all right."
"I am so glad,"
exclaimed the girl in blue.
"What set him off?" asked Mark. "How did it all happen, anyhow?"
"I woke up to find him in my stateroom," Jack said. "Gee, I must have slept late," he went on, seeing that the others were fully dressed.
"We didn't call you," explained Mark. "We've all been up some time. It's hard to tell when it's night or morning with the sun always shining, but this occurrence is queer," he went on. "Does Jan Tu often get spells like that?"
"No, it is only since he was injured," explained Protexa. "But have no fear. We will keep him locked in his room from now on."
"What set him against me?" asked Jack wonderingly. "I never did anything to him. Never saw him before, as far as I know."
"That is true," admitted Protexa in a low voice as Gozona went back to her room, "but he would have acted the same toward you or you,"
and in turn he indicated the professor and Mark.
"What's the reason?" Mark asked.
"He is what you call, it is hard to get the right word, but when one person likes another and does not want another to likewise have a fondness, it is..."
"Do you mean jealousy?" asked the professor.
"That is it. The gypsies from whom I learned what little English I have were very, what you call, jealous. Jan Tu is the same."
"But of whom is Jan Tu jealous?" burst out Jack.
"You and your two friends,"
was the unexpected answer.
"Me?" cried Professor Hertz, with a hearty laugh. "Why, I'm an old man with grown-up children."
"It matters not," went on Protexa. "Jan Tu so loves Gozona that he would be jealous even of a woman who loved her. We all on Venus love our beautiful young scientist, he went on. For Gozona is one of our foremost astronomers. It was she who conceived the idea of going to the Earth to learn more about it than our telescopes showed. We had long wondered whether or not it was inhabited. Now we know. Yes, we all love Gozona in Venus, but some more than others. Jan, too, was a suitor for her hand, even as I was, and he smiled a bit pathetically. But she has vowed never to marry. She says she will devote her life to science. However, this did not prevent Jandu from loving her, and I suppose he could not bear the little attention she gave to you people of the Earth. If he had had his way, he never would have permitted her to go to seek help of any on your planet. He would have been content to die, as we all would have had to do when Bitam and the Gasto gave out. Had not Gozona insisted on finding you two young men, of whom she heard through the gypsies.
I am glad she sought us out, said Mark.
So am I, said Protexa. But Jantu is a very passionate man, and I think his injuries, sustained when he fell with the rescue ship, have turned his brain. He has had mild outbursts before, while you were at work repairing our ship. That is why we had to keep him sedated. Soli and I can control him by a hypnotic power we possess over him. That is why he has been kept in his room. But this morning we were careless and allowed the power to wane, went on Protexa. And I suppose he went on this mad rampage in consequence. But we will guard him well after this. I will put him into a deep hypnotic sleep that will last until we reach Venus.
I hope you can, said Jack with a smile as he rubbed his throat. Being waked up by a mad lover who wants to choke you to death isn't exactly pleasant.
I am sorry, said Protexa simply, but you will be in no more danger.
The excitement caused by the sudden attack on Jack soon passed, and nothing more was seen of Jantu that day. The door of his room was kept tightly shut, and the only ones who entered were Protexa and Soli. Gozona ceased her visits, which, so Protexa informed the Earth dwellers, had been prompted only by kindness to see if she could alleviate some of the pain and suffering caused by Jantu's injuries. With making hourly observations to check their rate of progress, putting new charges of that strange powder into the engine of gold, looking from the portholes now and then, and eating when they felt hungry, what corresponded to a day soon passed for Mark, Jack, and the scientist. In 48 hours more, providing we keep up this same speed, we ought to land on Venus, said Jack on beginning what would be the second night, though there was no sign of darkness.
Yes, said the captain, looking at the speed gauge. We are doing very well.
How do you make a landing without going all to smash? Asked Mark. You haven't any landing gear or compression plungers, as far as I can see.
That is controlled by the engine of gold, was the answer. We set up a current of negative gravity and we land on Venus as gently as what you call a feather. The Earth landing, not only of the first car in which Gozona and I traveled, but also that of Jantu and Soli, should have been equally gentle and there should have been no accident, but we did not know accurately the density of your atmosphere and could not take the proper precautions. But we know about Venus, and there will be no smash.
That's a consoling thought, said Jack. But I wonder if we can control the blue streak when we shoot back to Earth in it. How about that, Protexa? The captain did not answer. Instead, he sprang to his feet and pointed toward one of the heavy glass windows. Mark and his companion saw that they were hurtling into a queer yellow cloud or haze.
Quick! The masks! Cried Protexa. It is the yellow snow! Breathe it not at your peril! The masks! Quick!
He sprang toward the locker in which they were kept. At the same moment, the Earth dwellers became aware of a sweet, sickish odor that was penetrating the metal sides of the craft. It was overpowering like an anesthetic. They began to feel very faint.
Chapter 14, The Wandering Comet.
Fully aware of the danger that surrounded them, Protexa had acted not a moment too soon. In an instant of time, he had tossed protecting masks to the three Earth dwellers and then donned one himself. Even in the midst of this terror, Jack could not help noticing, as he said to Mark afterward, that Protexa acted as a true host, for he first supplied his guests with the protecting masks and then got one for himself. He also tossed one to Soli. There was a sinister reason for this preference, as the three visitors were to learn soon and to their sorrow. However, now it seemed a very gracious gesture to them. In the forward part of the blue streak, Gozona was also made aware of the entrance of the craft into that murky yellow cloud. For no sooner had the five in the engine room donned their masks than they saw the girl in blue coming toward them, also wearing one. Protexa motioned to ask if she had given one to Jan too, and she signed in assent. Relying on the protection of the queer contrivances which covered their heads completely, enabling them to breathe greatly condensed oxygen from a small chamber of it in the top of the mask, the Earthborn could now view more composedly the strange phenomenon about them. The blue streak was hurtling along in a dense cloud of yellow vapor, and the remark of Protexa that it was snow seemed borne out by the evidence of the eyes of the Earth dwellers. It must be remembered that on this voyage through space, the passengers were hermetically sealed within the projectile or ship in which they were traveling. In no other way could they have made the trip. So all the knowledge those in the blue streak could gather of the yellow vapor was of its penetrating odor and by observation through the thick glass portholes. But the description given in that hasty warning by Protexa that it was snow was plainly true. Great yellow flakes sifted around the speeding craft and dashed against the glass windows. The flakes were larger than any ever observed on Earth, and they seemed to be frozen vapor, for they melted on touching the warm airship, and little trickling streams of water, like yellow ochre, ran down the glass of the ports. At one time, the blue streak ran into such a dense cloud of the yellow snow that the interior of the craft was considerably darkened, and the glow lights had to be switched on. This was evidently the center of the curious storm, as after that the darkness grew less, and in about 15 minutes they had passed completely through the disturbance, and the last of the yellow flakes was left behind. But when, observing this from a port, Jack was about to take off his mask, Gozona, with a quick gesture and a negative shake of her head, indicated to him that he must not do so. The other Earth dwellers, likewise, retained their protective coverings. The reason for this was obvious to everyone in the blue streak. Since the gas, or whatever it was that was given off by the yellow snow, could penetrate the double metal hull of the craft, it followed that some of the vapor would remain in the cabin and other compartments after the craft had passed through the cloud. Until the last atom of the deadly gas had been removed, it would not be safe to take off the masks. But once out of the region of that queer storm, Protexa and Soli hastened to the clearing of the interior of the craft of the vapor by increasing the generation of oxygen from the machine set up for that purpose. By consulting the atmosmometer, a device similar to a thermometer, the captain was able to ascertain when it was safe to take off the uncomfortable headpieces. This was about 10 minutes after the last of the yellow flakes had been seen. "Whew, it's good to get that off," exclaimed Jack, laying aside his mask.
"I should say so," agreed his chum. "They are not nice, but they save lives," remarked Gozona as she glided from the room.
It was not without some pangs of jealousy that Mark and Jack saw her go into the room where the crazy Jan 2 lay in a hypnotic stupor. But they observed that Gozona did not remain long, merely going in to relieve the unfortunate Venusian of his protective mask. The jealous feeling was soon forgotten as the young man heard the professor asking Protexa something about the yellow snow. Ever on the alert to absorb any scientific knowledge they could, Mark and Jack listened to the captain's reply.
"We do not know what it is," said Protexa, "and probably never shall find out, but it is death to breathe its gas for more than a few minutes."
"Then you have seen it before?" asked Professor Hertz.
"Oh yes, others of our scientists have also," was the reply. "You see," he added with a smile, "this is not our first trip through space. We have visited Mercury, though our stay there was short on account of the terrific heat. Being only 35 million miles from the Sun, while Venus is 67 million miles removed. We have also gone to Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus, and on each occasion we have passed through one or more storms of yellow snow. It may be that it would not be encountered if we went to the planet Neptune, but that trip we have not yet been able to arrange for. We may, however, sometime."
"Why haven't you been to Neptune, if you have been to all the other planets, including ours?" asked Jack.
"Because of the terrible distance," was the answer. Some of our people thought we never could make Uranus, which, as you know, is 1,800,000,000 miles from the sun, making it a journey for us of almost that extent, lacking only the 67,000,000 miles that we are distant from the sun. But when you remember that Neptune is twice as far from us as is Uranus, the perils of that trip will be appreciated.
I should say so, agreed Mark.
As it was, making the trip to Uranus, we were barely able to get back, having failed to take enough Bitam and Gasto with us, went on Protexa. However, if our people are able to make us a more condensed form of these very necessary substances, so we can take a large quantity in a small space, we may yet reach Neptune, which I have calculated is 3 billion miles from Venus. This distance is somewhat greater than the figures given by your Earth astronomers, he said to Professor Hertz, but I am convinced that my calculations are right.
I am not inclined to dispute you, said the Earth scientist with a smile, but I am curious as to how the deadly nature of the yellow snow was discovered.
It was by ignoring it, when our early space explorers went to visit Jupiter, that it was found that it meant death to breathe its vapor, said the captain. Many years ago, some of our astronomers set off in one of the first of crafts like this. They passed through some yellow snow, as we learn from the notes they made, but they were all killed.
How did you find that out? Asked Mark.
Their spacecraft, uncontrolled and containing the dead bodies, fell back on Venus, was the answer. It was opened, and some of those who rushed in hoping to rescue the crew were also killed by the few remaining fumes of the yellow crystals. But the vapor was soon dispersed, and then the hasty notes written by those who succumbed to the deadly poison were read, and in future trips, proper precautions were taken. Ever since, when we travel through space, we are ready with gas masks to don as soon as we observe the yellow snow. The poison vapor from it can penetrate any thickness. Our masks alone, chemically treated, neutralize it.
It's bad stuff, all right, observed Jack.
I hope the remainder of our journey back to Venus will be more pleasant, said the captain a little later, when they were all, with the exception of Jan 2, gathered in the main cabin.
He and Soli, with the beautiful girl in blue, had dined in their own way on Gasto and Bitam, while the professor and the two young scientists had made a more substantial meal on the food they had brought with them. It is all interesting, said Jack. The only thing that worries me is that, when we are navigating this ship back to Earth, we may run into worse perils than the yellow snow. We now know how to guard against that, but if something unforeseen should happen, what would we do? For a moment, Protexa did not answer, and Mark thought he saw him and Soli looking at each other in a peculiar manner. To make sure of this, and to ascertain, if possible, whether there was any basis for an alarming suspicion that had entered his mind, Mark asked pointedly,
"Do you think, Protexa, that we shall be able to manage this blue streak by ourselves? I mean, when we three start back to Earth?"
"You have been instructed how to operate the engines," was the captain's answer. "You need have no fear on that score. Do not be alarmed."
And then, as if to change the subject, he added,
"Would you not like to hear some music?"
"Music! Ah, yes!" exclaimed the professor, who had all the German fondness for melody. "But I have seen no piano or other instrument on board. Perhaps, though, you or our gracious lady will sing without accompaniment." And he looked at Gozona.
"When I said music," replied Protexa with a smile, "I had reference to the radio. Though whether we can get contact with your Earth or with Venus remains to be seen. Perhaps we are too distant from either planet to ensure good reception. I will, however, try."
He adjusted the radio set, but all that came from it were some distressing howls, and he had to give it up.
"We are about halfway between Venus and the Earth," he said, "and our set is not powerful enough to pick up signals from either place. But that need not prevent us from having a concert. You have doubtless heard of the music of the spheres," he questioned.
"Often," exclaimed the professor eagerly. "I have often wanted to listen to it, but I have never been able to devise an instrument delicate enough to catch those wonderful melodies. One of the red dwarfs on the city beyond the clouds had a machine which, though crudely made, seemed to bring in faint music from distant stars. He was one of the best of those imps," went on the professor, "and if things had gone differently, I should have liked to go further into the matter with him. But we had to leave there in a hurry," he concluded with a wry smile.
About this sphere music, said Mark, I don't mind admitting my ignorance and saying I've never heard of it.
There has long been a theory among some scientists, explained Professor Hertz, while Protexa went to a piece of apparatus and began adjusting it. A theory that the stars and planets, in moving through space, generate certain beautiful music beyond the range of human ears. Whether it is really true or not, I am unable to state.
You will not long be in doubt, said Gozona. Listen! She pointed to the instrument, something like a radio set, which Protexa was adjusting. A moment later, a rosy glow came from it. Instantly, the cabin was filled with a wild, though beautiful melody, played in a harmony like nothing the young men or the professor had ever heard on Earth. It seemed to lift them out of themselves, and, as Mark said later, could be likened to nothing but a wonderful orchestra, with instruments of a range and power and delicacy unknown on Earth. Now as soft as a summer wind, and again howling like a hurricane blast, but always melodious, the music of the spheres filled them all with unknown longings. At times, it soothed them to the verge of slumber, and again it seemed to invite them to dance. So much so, in the latter respect, that, at one point, Jack was almost irresistibly impelled to invite Gozona to waltz with him. But he did resist, for he did not know how the girl in blue would look upon this.
It is wonderful, amazing, exclaimed Mark softly.
Best concert I ever heard, Professor, said Jack.
The old German scientist sat with closed eyes. He had not moved since the first strains of the sphere music were heard. Now he seemed to come back as if from a trance.
I have been in the realms of the blessed, he said in a low voice. I have been taken out of myself, beyond the sordid cares of the world. It was like nothing I ever before experienced. I thank you, sir, he said, and he bowed gravely to Protexa.
Such is the music of the spheres, was the answer.
The Earth Dwellers retired soon after that, the echoes of the strange melodies still ringing in their ears. It was broad daylight, but they must have sleep. On and on through space, the blue streak shot. What corresponded to the second night passed peacefully, and when morning, if such it can be called, was ushered in, and the Earth Dwellers assembled at their breakfast, Jack remarked, "We ought to be there by tonight."
"Or by this time tomorrow," said Protexa. "The yellow snow deflected us from our path, but we are again on our course."
Some adjustments were necessary to the machinery after the meal, and Jack and the professor were helping make them when Mark, who had gone to the forward observation compartment, came running back in a state of great excitement.
"Venus ahead!" he shouted exultantly. "Venus ahoy!"
"It cannot be!" exclaimed Protexa, dropping the instrument he held. "We are not due for 24 hours.
"Well, I see some sort of planet looming up ahead," declared Mark. "It's different from any others we've sighted," he added, for in the journey through space they had, necessarily, passed different stars and some unknown planets.
"Better take a look," he advised the captain. "You know more about this region than I do." With an anxious look on his face, Protexa followed Mark to the observation room. Jack and the professor trailed along. No sooner had the captain looked at what Mark indicated than he cried,
"Turn on the repulse power! We must avoid this at any cost!"
"What is it?" asked Jack, as he saw a long distance ahead what seemed to be merely a mass of vapor.
"It's a wandering comet," cried Protexa. "It has no fixed orbit. At least, we've never discovered its orbit, and is as likely to crash into us as it is to pass us by. We must try to repulse it, to keep it away. There is no time to lose."
Chapter 15. A Giant Meteor.
Though, in their previous voyages through space, Jack Darrow, Mark Sampson, and in one case Professor Hertz had obtained distant views of comets, this was the first time they had been so near a direct contact. Little is known of comets. Opinion is divided as to whether they are a solid body like a meteor, or whether they consist merely of a mass of luminous gas, or of millions of small particles of matter held together by some attraction and, as such, wandering through space. There was no time, now, to discuss theories about comets. Evidently, Protexa realized the danger of crashing into one, or having it hit the blue streak, if he did not know the exact nature of the mysterious sky traveler.
"What are we to do?" cried Jack. "She's coming nearer!"
Oh, we are prepared for this emergency, quickly answered the captain. We have a repulsing machine on board that is designed somewhat on the principle of our negative gravity apparatus to deflect comets and other eccentrically moving bodies of space. Come, I will show you how it works.
Why can't you steer the blue streak past the comet? Asked the professor. He and the boys knew the craft could be guided somewhat as an airship of the plane type is steered. Only in the case of the blue streak, the direction of the craft to right or left or up and down was done by different streams of rocket gas from the base. There were four propelling tubes. When all four were operated, the blue streak was kept on a straight course in the direction in which she was originally headed. To send her to the left, the issuance of gas from that tube was shut off and, with power coming from the right side of the base, curved the projectile that way. The two elevating tubes at the same time being in operation, the craft kept the height originally determined. To go higher, the upper tube was cut off, and the lower one alone used. Conversely, to descend, the lower tube power was dispensed with, and the upper one allowed to function, which depressed the nose of the ship.
Yes, we can steer ourselves, said Protexa, but it is of little use to try to steer out of the way of a comet. They behave in what seems to us such an eccentric manner that if we went to the left, they might go to the right, and we would collide. Likewise, the same if we tried to go above or below it. The only way is to set up a repelling force and try to give a new impetus to the comet. In that way, we may be able to shunt it off on another orbit so we can pass in safety.
Though their danger was great and imminent, the captain of the Blue Streak did not lose his nerve, nor did Soli. Gozona came from her cabin, and, seeming to know as much about the mechanism of the craft as did either of her companions, she turned wheels, adjusted gauges, set switches, and in every way helped to get the repelling machine into shape for the exercise of its power. Jack, Mark, and the professor did as they were told, mixing up certain chemicals in test tubes and pouring them into metal chambers.
"We should have had this engine in instant readiness," said the captain, "but we did not use it on our trip to your Earth, and our assistant astronomers, who computed a chart for us, said there was no danger of any comet being encountered for several months. But I should have been ready for emergencies, knowing as I do from experience that our knowledge of comets is as yet far from adequate. However, we shall do our best."
"Are we in any immediate danger?" asked Jack.
"Yes, we are," was the answer. "Though that comet is many thousands of miles away, its speed is terrific, exceeding our own at present. I can increase our speed if needful, but I think this method of trying to shunt the comet to one side will be better. If you will go to the forward observatory," he went on to Jack, "and will signal what you see, we shall be able to use our judgment back here. You can communicate with us over this," and he indicated an instrument on the wall of the motor room.
Jack hurried forward again. He was startled by what he observed. Right ahead, though of course a long distance away, was a great mass of swirling white vapor. As it parted now and again, as clouds do, the young scientist had glimpses of billowing flames.
"So that's what a comet is," cried Jack. "A moving mass of fire. If we get involved in that, good night!"
He telephoned back what he had seen, and Protexa said,
"We have yet a chance. That is only the gas envelope of the comet. The body itself is solid and dark in color. When you see that, let me know, and I will try to avoid it."
"Right," called back Jack, and he stared through the heavy glass window in the end of the blue streak. He remembered how once, when a comet was seen to be nearing the Earth, the astronomers computed that our world would pass through the tail. There was some speculation as to whether or not the Earth would be destroyed, but most of the scientists declared that the comet's tail was only a thin gas that could work no harm. So it proved. At least, if the Earth did pass through the tail of the comet, no one knew about it and nothing happened. "But this thing doesn't look so innocent," mused Jack, as he held his post of observation. "If we drive into that cloud of fire, we'll be in trouble." Nearer and nearer, the blue streak approached the comet. At last, Jack caught a glimpse of what seemed to be a dark core of the vaporous mass. "Look out!" he warned those in the engine room over the telephone.
"Turn on the power!"
called Protexa to Soli and the two Earth dwellers. They had been told what to do, and did it quickly. Gozona was at a lever that required all her strength to shift, but she managed it. Then came a period of anxious waiting.
There was a whir of wheels in the strange repulsing machine, and strange lights gleamed about it. For a moment, no effect was observed. Then a strange force seemed to grip the craft. She tilted to one side, and then the other. "It is the attraction of the comet!" cried the captain. "We must have more repelling power!" He made an adjustment to the apparatus, while Soli put in more of the strange chemical, and Gozona let some drops of red liquid trickle into a cylinder. A shudder seemed to pass through the blue streak. It was as though two forces were contending for the mastery of her. Would the power of the repelling engine overcome that of the comet? The telephone bell tinkled above the roar of the machinery. Professor Hertz sprang to answer. "Val?" he cried. Back came Jack's answer. "All right, the comet is shearing off into space." "And just in time," exclaimed Protexa when he was told this. "We had used the last atom of our power. A fraction more pull from the comet and we would have collided with it. Now the danger is past."
"Would it not be well," suggested Gozona, "to run the repelling engine a little longer?"
"Oh, I intend to," replied the captain. "I will take no chances."
The comet was soon a long way off. Not until then was the repelling machinery shut down. Then once more the travelers breathed freely. They were all glad to rest after that terrific strain, and for a few hours no one did anything except what was necessary. The machinery needed little attention, a slight change in direction being given now and then to keep the craft headed for Venus. Professor Hertz turned on the machine and again listened to the music of the spheres. He almost wept in sheer delight at the beauty of the melodies he heard. A little later, Protexa, coming into the cabin, said,
"I think I can now get our planet on the radio."
He went to the regular radio, and talk of the same kind the Earth travelers had heard the Venusians speak soon came from the loudspeaker. Gozona, Soli, and Protexa smiled in delight at this evidence of nearing their home, but the captain, knowing his guests were not familiar with the language, tuned in a different station where music was being broadcast.
"That is the language universal," he said with a smile.
"Yes, indeed, music knows no boundaries," said the professor. They listened for some time to the concert from Venus, and Jack was about to propose that it might be a good thing if he and his two companions knew a little of the language of the strange planet, when Gozona suddenly pointed to a thermometer on the wall of the cabin.
"Look!" she exclaimed.
"How fast it is rising!" said Mark. "I've been noticing that it's been getting warm in here for the last few minutes," said Jack. "Can there be anything wrong in the engine room?" he asked the captain.
"I'll go and look," offered Soli.
Before he could leave the cabin, Professor Hertz cried, "There is what causes the heat!" He pointed to a great red flame that could be seen through one of the glass ports hovering in space just beyond the speeding craft.
"A meteor!" cried the captain. "A giant flaming meteor, and passing dangerously close!" he added, "dangerously close!"
To all my listeners, I hope the program you have just heard has made your day just that little bit better. I look forward to reading your cards and letters over the air. Send them to Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. If you wish to tip the storyteller and are not comfortable mailing wads of cash, you can go to paypal.me/prometheuslives. Every little bit is greatly appreciated. A recurring gift of support at patreon.com/publius_reads will be acknowledged with benefits such as individual downloadable chapters. Until next time, this has been
Hear Now the Words.
Oh,